Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Europe's an economic mess with riots in the streets. The once mighty U.S. economy still hasn't found its feet post-meltdown. And in China, the high-rises keep on rising. State capitalism is booming while free market Western economies stumble. This was not the prediction at the end of the Cold War, but it is the world today. This hour on Point, the global showdown between free market economies and state capitalism. You can join the conversation. Could it be that a great free market era is ending, has ended? And what does it mean when economies directed by authoritarian political power, think China, think Russia, take the lead? What's happening here? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got two big thinkers on the economic showdown with us today, but first we go to China, a rash of suicides at Foxconn Technology, and a two-week strike at a Chinese Honda plant have put wage demands and walkout in the spotlight. Chinese factory workers are demanding more, and the Chinese government is letting it happen. Joining me now from Beijing to look at the labor unrest is NPR Beijing correspondent Anthony Kuhn. Anthony Kuhn, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, nice to join you again, Tom.
So what's going on? We're not accustomed to China really permitting much in the way of labor unrest. What's happening?
Well, I guess you could say that a generation of inexpensive Chinese labor and an arrangement in which foreign companies came to assemble their products in China is coming undone at the seams. Younger people these days have higher expectations of standards of living and of job satisfaction. Industrial wages have stagnated for nearly a generation, and young people are finding that they don't have to put up with it anymore, and they don't. And we've got industrial action, as you mentioned, at Foxconn and ongoing at Honda. The people who make locks for Honda cars in China are still striking. They're going to expected to continue striking on Friday. And I think what we're seeing is, you know, the beginning of a rise in Chinese wages. It's not going to happen overnight. I mean, there are huge constraints on the system, if you think about it. For example, labor unions. Even the Communist Party's People Daily newspaper says this union has to do a better job. But is the party really going to allow the proletariat to operate independently? That's hard to say. Also, the other factor is the household registration system, which prevents rural migrant workers from settling in cities and really becoming a permanent industrial workforce. The police don't want that raised. But, you know, this trend is clearly in progress already. And, you know, minimum wages in Chinese cities are expected to rise by about 20%. Strikes have hit not just Foxconn and Honda, but also people, companies that make Adidas shoes, Japan's sewing machine maker Brother. It seems to be catching on, and the wages are rising. I mean, look at Foxconn. They promised their workers a wage hike of two-thirds, more than 60%,
wow.
and yet those wages are still going to be less than $300 a month. What that tells people is that they're still very cheap. The labor is still cheap compared to developed companies. And also, you know, just as our economy is very much built around the consumer, the Chinese economy remains centered on the producer. China still has a very low percentage of GDP made up by consumption, and a very small part of GDP is made up for by wages and income. So that has to start changing.
Anthony, it's always been an irony of the People's Republic that that labor was kept in such tight check. Now, a number of the job actions you're talking about here, maybe even strikes, have been against Honda. It's obviously a Japanese foreign company. You mentioned Brother, a Japanese company. Are these also being permitted, strikes, straight-up strikes, being permitted against Chinese-owned companies?
Yes, it's happening all over. And, you know, the whole export sector is being hit hard, not only by the labor unrest, but also by expectations that China's currency is going to rise. thereby making Chinese exports more expensive. And this is what China's government really wants to happen. They want the economy to be more consumption-driven, and for that to happen, wages have got to go up. So that's why they're allowing this to happen. And short of really allowing independent organization, they're allowing a fair amount of industrial action and unrest in the production centers of the Pearl River Delta and the Yangtze River Delta around Shanghai.
Can they keep up the kind of growth, breakneck growth? 8% is what they seem to aim for as kind of a minimum to stay ahead of their big population and its demands. Can China maintain its economic growth rate if it has higher wages?
Yes. These companies are not going to be moving out of China. These companies are going to start producing for the internal market. As wages go up, people will have more money to buy stuff. Also, imports will rise. That will all help to drive growth. 8% is the target they set for the economy. It's a sort of a shibboleth. It's a target they have to have. Whether it actually makes that target or not remains to be seen. But, they are in a phase of very strong economic growth, marked by a lot of buying of housing and cars and heavy industrial goods. And that this growth spurt is expected by a lot of analysts to last for, 10, 15, 20 years.
That's a long time. What might it mean for Americans, let's say, Anthony? If Chinese wages rise, more job actions, more wage increases, does that mean higher prices at Walmart?
Well, that's what people fear, of course. But if you look at the composition of the pricing of, T-shirts, Barbie dolls, sneakers, iPods, the labor component, the amount that gets paid to Chinese workers is really very little. There's much more in the raw materials, in the packaging, the advertising. So, yes, they are going to be paying more for the labor component, but it's not expected to hike up prices a lot further. Besides, if you look at the other alternatives, where can producers go? They can go to Bangladesh, Vietnam, Eastern Europe, mm-hmm. but none of these countries really have the infrastructure, the size of the labor pool. It's going to be very hard for them to match China in many ways for years to come.
Anthony Kuhn, NPR Beijing correspondent, looking at labor unrest, rising wages, and a booming economy in China. Anthony, thank you very much for joining us from Beijing.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Joining us now from New York is Ian Bremmer. He's president of the Eurasia Group, a political risk research and consulting group. He writes the Call blog on foreignpolicy.com. He's author of The J-Curve, A New Way to Understand Why Nations Rise and Fall. His new book is The End of the Free Market, Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations. Ian Bremmer, thank you very much for being with us.
Tom, my pleasure to be here.
I wish you'd kick us right off with a story you tell from just about a year ago, May 2009. You're in New York City. You sit down at a kind of a fancy gathering at the Chinese consulate on the 12th Avenue in Manhattan with China's vice foreign minister, He Yafei, and he puts a pretty interesting assertion on the table. Take us there.
He does, and seats me right across from him. And the first question he directed to me, and he said, so Ian, now that the free market has failed, what do you think the appropriate role of the state in the global economy should be?
The free market has failed. And was he just pulling your leg, or is that the way the vice foreign minister of China sees the world?
Well, he smiled when he said it, and he's a clever fellow. He's, by the way, the fellow when Obama was in Copenhagen and the premier didn't show up at the last minute. Mm-hmm. He Yafei was the fellow that Obama ended up meeting with. Mm-hmm. So interesting and storied history around this guy. Clearly, the Chinese government sees that the excesses of the free market have gotten the West in a lot of trouble. They also know that they are committed to a different model. And I think, in the same way that a lot of folks in the U.S. like to say that Obama's a socialist when they know that Obama's not a socialist, You have the Chinese government saying the free market has failed because they can score a lot of domestic political points that way.
What is this new creature? Americans knew or thought they knew what communism was. But now you're talking about the big competitor to free market economics being state capitalism. Define it for us.
It is different, and it's been coming for a while. Uses lots of different tools like national oil corporations and sovereign wealth funds and state-owned enterprises, privately owned national champions. But they're all about a system where an authoritarian government uses the markets and market mechanisms for ultimately political gains. And that is a very different kind of system than a free market system, regulated or unregulated, that we've seen over the last years. The analogy I like to use is you think of a soccer field, and if the free market, if a well-regulated free market is one where the government is a referee and tells people what the rules are and officiates, that in a state capitalist system, the referee tells one of the teams what the rules are and stacks that team with members of his friends and family. So, when Hillary Clinton goes to Beijing and says she wants a level playing field, this is a little bit of what she's talking about.
It seems about 5 minutes ago that the whole big braying message to the world was the free markets have won. They've won forever. State control is anathema and deadly. Are you really saying that state capitalism has pulled into the lead here? Are free market economies really, like, eating their dust?
Well, there's no question that what's happened in the last 2 years has meant that even though the free market economies may be larger, it is politically almost indefensible and certainly very uncomfortable for leaders of free market economies to come out and say, we're behind these values. And that's something that we're going to have to be dealing with for a long time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China, Russia up, the U.S., Europe down, and the new global horse race, maybe, between free market economies and state capitalism. Ian Bremmer is with us. He's out with a new book, The End of the Free Market, Who Wins? The War Between States and Corporations. Ian Bremmer's got it right in his title, The End of the Free Market, but he's kind of a long-term optimist about free markets and their power of regeneration. Clyde Prestowitz is not so sure. His new book is The Betrayal of American Prosperity, Free Market Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. He joins us from Washington. Clyde Prestowitz, thanks very much for being here. Welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Clyde, I remember you hard at work back in the 80s. I was covering your work in Japan, you know, wrestling with the great Japanese threat at that time. But hey, you know, we went on to the super prosperity of the 90s, so maybe this is just another version of that. You know, a big scare, but we'll be fine, thanks.
Right. Well, it's interesting because back in the 80s, we didn't call it state capitalism. We called it Japan Inc.
Right.
And then after that, we called it the Tigers,
mm-hmm.
you know, and now it's of course, China. But it's the same concept of state-guided or strategic economic development. And we thought that we had triumphed in the 90s. Japan kind of hit a wall with their bursting of their bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we had the dot-com bubble, and then we had the housing bubble, which made us think that we had won. But actually, you look back at it, the dot-com bubble collapsed, the housing bubble collapsed, and here we are. And so really, in my view, the 90s and the aughties was kind of a Potemkin village for us. And we now find ourselves kind of in the same situation we were in the early 80s vis-a-vis Japan, except that the numbers now are bigger. Our position is relatively weaker, and whereas Japan was a client state of the United States, China definitely is not.
Mm. You know, I wonder what each of you think. I mean, when you're sitting across the table, Ian, from He Yafei or Chinese officials, do they really think that they've got, A, a different system, and, B, they're winning or perhaps have won, that the world is simply not going to be a free market economy, period?
I think that if you are sitting across the table from China, the first thing you're always focused on is political survival, short-term and long-term. And you know you need economic growth, sustained economic growth to make that happen.
If you're a Chinese official, if you're the Chinese Communist Party. Okay.
That's right. No question. And I think that what you see in the last 2 years is a lot of Chinese officials saying, you know what, we see that the United States and the Europeans and the Japanese are under unprecedented strain, And we're conservative by nature. We're long-term strategists by nature. We don't think that it is wise for us to bet on them the way we used to. And so as a consequence, we are going to a hedge. We're going to start decoupling. And they are doing that. They're diversifying their exports away from the West. They're building up domestic consumption. They're engaged in indigenous innovation so that they will be able to maintain more profitability that stays in China. But all of those things are fundamentally problematic for the West and for multinational corporates based in the West.
Clyde, I mean, I think a lot of people watched China's rise and its state-guided, very, very often state-owned capitalism and thought, well, okay, this is different. This is kind of a hybrid. It may be pretty big, but China will play through an essentially free market world. And the picture we're being offered by Ian and by you is no, it's going to be the other way. It may increasingly be a state capitalism world with free market economies in trouble. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that is right. We had a mantra in the 90s. We embraced the globalization as kind of Americanization, and our mantra was that globalization will make everybody rich. Being rich, they'll be democratic. Being democratic, they'll be like us. And we thought the transmission belt of that democratization and Americanization would be the global corporation. What we're finding is that, in fact, it's a little bit different. The global corporation in Washington or London or Brussels is a very powerful political player. Mm-hmm. But in Beijing, it's not. And so actually the global corporation has to be kind of more responsive to and more solicitous of the authoritarian regime than it does of the democratic regime. In the democratic regime, mm-hmm. the global corporation is influential.
Buys influence.
And the authoritarian regime is deferential. And so the transmission goes the other way.
Wow. I guess in every system there are in circumstance there are advantages and disadvantages. Ian, if this is happening, what advantages and for whom will it, is it producing, and what problems is it, will it produce?
Well, the advantages, of course, in the short term are that the Chinese respond to crises very well. You need $600 billion and you need it spent on infrastructure and stimulus immediately as there's a global crisis. The Chinese do that better than anyone else. They can mobilize.
They've just done it in the last year and a half.
They have indeed. Mm-hmm. And we're in the United States. You've got to get this through Congress, and then you have to get it through the state legislatures. And, you know, in Europe, it's even worse. There's much more decentralization, and they're experiencing enormous problems with their bailouts as a consequence of that.
Meanwhile, China's building high-speed rail like a mile a second all over the country, laying down huge canals, huge infrastructure spending.
Look, I think it's very clear that coming out of the worst global crisis that the world has experienced since the Great Depression, that the Chinese model right now looks strongest. And that's something that we're going to have to deal with for years. This is not just today or tomorrow. But I think we also need to recognize that the brittleness of the Chinese regime and the unsustainability of state capitalism long term is a serious problem for them.
Okay, let's put that to the side for just a minute, because I want to come to that, and I know you and Clyde may differ on that, but speak first in the interim here. What problems is this rise then, even dominance of state capitalism, likely to create for the global economy, for the U.S. and Europe?
Well, I think there are three major things we need to know. The first is that since you're not going to be as globalized, you're not going to have as much access to global capital markets, labor markets, and consumer markets.
Because they'll be sewn up by state capitalists?
They'll be sewn up and there'll be fights. It's not just one system. It's mm-hmm. state preferences and the rest, and that creates protectionist backlash. That means you're going to see lower economic growth. That's number one. Number two, you're going to see regionalization of capital and trade flows that will be politically driven. And number three, and this is critical, I ask in the subtitle of my book, Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations? And I want to be very clear. If you are a corporation in a war with a state, you're going to lose. We saw one of those already this year. It's Google Zero, China One. Mm-hmm. The Chinese government's come out in the last week and started with their state-owned media strongly criticizing Goldman Sachs. It's a run on companies beginning with G, apparently, but they're in trouble if this continues. And if you're a company that is facing a state-owned enterprise or private champion that has support from the Chinese government, you're going to have to either find a way to make nice-nice with the Chinese government or you're going to leave. And that is the biggest problem coming. You're Steve Ballmer from Microsoft last week saying that China is not your future anymore, when these were the guys with Bill Gates that hosted the Chinese to their house in Washington a few years ago. This is a very different world for these corporations.
Clyde Cann, free market economics, the United States, Europe, flourish in such a world.
Well, I think we need to make a distinction. The United States and Europe are not the same thing. If you look at Europe right now, we're thinking that they're in trouble, and a lot of Europe is. But let's look at Germany. Germany is very competitive, and Germany's getting more competitive. Germany's not state capitalism, but it's a kind of government, industry, strategic thinking, long-term capitalism, cooperation between the corporations and the government, using the market, that has proven to be pretty successful. I mean, Germany has high wages, strong labor unions, but it is very competitive.
So what are you saying? It's just the United States that's...
I'm saying the U.S. is in big trouble, right. And I disagree a little bit with Ian. I don't think the battle is between state capitalism and corporations. Ian's right. If the corporation goes against the Chinese government, it's going to lose. But the corporations won't go against the Chinese government. Google was a big exception.
Right.
The corporations are going to line up with where the power is. I think the real battle... And you know, you may be in a situation in which China makes mistakes, or I mean, we've seen Japan make mistakes. We saw the Tigers make mistakes. Ian's right. In the short term, they can be react very quickly.
Right.
Longer term, they tend to build excess capacity. They tend to get excess exports, which causes problems.
But for regular Americans,
but they can do all that. They can make mistakes, and it still hurts us. And the real issue here is, what kind of a future are we going to have? Let me just cite one thing. President Obama was in November, in China in November, meeting with Hu Jintao. And in his press conference, Obama said that the U.S. would, one of the things they had agreed on was that the U.S. would assist China in developing its new commercial jet liner. Now, jet liners are one of the few things that we sell to China.
Boeing, right.
Why are we going to help them develop the jet liner?
I have no idea.
Hu Jintao would never tell Obama that he's going to help Obama develop a jet liner, you know? So what we need to do is to have a very different mentality about how we think or how we go about developing our economic wealth.
But if we don't, if we stay in the system we're in the mindset that, you know, we've had for a long, long time, what do you see coming, Clyde?
I see increasing erosion of U.S. wealth-producing capability, disappearance of the middle class, a dramatic undercutting of U.S. Overseas influence. I see us withdrawing our troops. We won't be able to afford to keep the troops in Asia, in Europe, in the Middle East. We're going to face the same dilemma that the Brits and Europeans have faced, that they can't afford to be a military power and also to handle their economic problems.
I've read you mapping out a scenario, Clyde, with 18% unemployment in the United States. American
bases around the world. Well, we have 18% right now.
Well, okay, if you put in everybody who's, you know,
right.
U.S. bases closed and China kind of ruling the Western Pacific. I mean, it sounds like a radical fall for the United States you're describing.
It is. And I mean, it doesn't have to happen. In fact, it would be pretty easy to turn things around. But the track that we're on right now leads to disaster.
Can you have freedom without free markets? Can you have state capitalism and have freedom as we've understood it?
You can have a high degree of freedom. I think of Singapore. Singapore is a very interesting model. And in fact, I think the Chinese have studied Singapore very carefully.
I would not raise it, though, as an icon of, wild freedom.
Well, but, you know, there's
which
a
we're
high
supposed
degree.
To be.
There's a high degree of freedom in Singapore. I mean, it's not a democracy like ours. But there's a high degree of freedom. People in Singapore do not feel oppressed.
Well, okay, but they're a different culture. I mean, I think a lot of Americans might feel the government breathing down their neck if they had to deal with Singapore's scheme of laws and rules.
Well, they probably would. But you know, the question is which model is going to kind of be most attractive globally. And right now, It's the Singapore model. It's the Chinese model. You know, travel to Latin America. In Latin America, they have democracy fatigue, and people in Latin America are saying, "Gee, we've done everything that the Washington consensus told us to do. We've deregulated. We've democratized. we've gotten rid of all the state-owned corporations, and we still don't grow." And maybe that Chinese model is not so bad. I mean, there is that very powerful effect.
Wow. What a picture. We're talking about a horse race, a real horse race between free market economies and state capitalism. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get some callers in here. Montgomery, Alabama. Doug, you are on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I agree with a lot of what your panel are talking about, but I look at back when in the 70s, we went through the same cycle with Japan, where everything, you know, a low cost labor market, which is China's about probably 10 times bigger than that, so we're going to go through the same thing with them that we went through with Japan, and slowly but surely they're going to have the same thing happen to them. They're going to end up raising wages and having the same economic problems that Japan had when they saturate the market, because they don't have a consumption-based economy.
Right. So just kind of wait it out, and we can emerge maybe on top again, as more or less happened with Japan. Ian, what about it?
Well, I think that the caller addresses something that's very important, which is that long-term, the sustainability of the Chinese model is open to very serious question. One of the things is demographics. Demographics are going to be turning against China in about 4 or 5 years and getting worse and worse. That happens at the same time that you have this wage push, so the Chinese get old before they get rich. They also are degrading their environment, you know, sort of beyond anything the world has ever experienced in terms of a large economy. And you're going to have lots of Western corporations that are increasingly unwilling to bring their technology over because it gets stolen. So the Chinese will have to develop their own innovations, but their educational system, their political system, and their economic system is not well set up to support that. So long term, you know, this is not a viable system. But long term isn't 2 years off. Your caller also suggested it's a hell of a lot bigger a bubble than Japan was. And when the bubble's going up, we know most investors, they want to be the last one off the bus. They don't want to be the first one.
Clyde, so, I mean, there's a little bit, though, of a sense of, you know, sit tight, stay free market, and we'll be fine ultimately.
Well, you know, as John Maynard Keynes said, in the long run, we're all dead. You can wait a very long time. But I think the caller actually is guilty of a bit of a fallacy. We've had this notion, number one, that Japan and the Asian countries have become competitive because of cheap labor. I think that's not right. I think right now, Intel's moving production of its Pentium chips to China. Applied Materials is moving all of its R&D and its major solar panel capacity to China. It's not just low tech, it's high tech, where we're also falling behind. And I think we have a view that we somehow triumphed over Japan. Well, Japan had problems, but, you know, we did not recover our position in any of the markets that Japan conquered. Wow. Japan remains with a big trade surplus. We remain with a huge trade deficit, even in high tech production.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China, Russia up, the U.S., Europe down, and the new global horse race between free market economies and state capitalism. Ian Bremmer and Clyde Prestowitz here. Bremmer's new book is The End of the Free Market: Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations? Clyde Prestowitz's book is The Betrayal of American Prosperity: Free Market Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. Both pretty bracing analyses of what's going on out there. You can read excerpts from each at our website, onpointradio.org. Glenn, in Arlington, Massachusetts, you're on the air, Glenn.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear. You're on.
Okay. I have trouble with drawing the line sharply between what's called private enterprise and government, when the size of the organization, the so-called private organization, gets to be really big. To me, something like General Motors or Bank of America or AIG being too big to fail means that they have held us and our government hostage. Essentially, they are the government. They are governing us by threatening our economy and forcing us to go in and subsidize them, because that's what it is. It's a subsidy. So I don't call General, I call General Motors a public institution, not a private one. And I call Bank of America a public institution because it has the same influence over the public that the government has.
Well, that's very interesting, Glenn. Let us pick that up. Ian Bremmer, take us to school on that front. I mean, is with the U.S. support for GM and AIG, maybe Bank of America, is that the same? Or what's the difference between that kind of bailout support and what the Chinese authorities do with the big players in their economy?
I'm sympathetic to what's behind the caller, which is that in both cases the public wheel seems to be subverted. But I also think we need to recognize a real difference in the problems that those two types of institutions have. A really big private sector organization in the context of a strong corporate lobby and a political system that sometimes feels captive to them and captured by them, the problems they tend to have is they focus on maximizing short-term profitability at the expense of long-term sustainability, long-term growth, and externalities that matter to the people of the country. And so you see, you know, got to make the numbers for your shareholder. Don't care. You know, sort of if that's going to expose you to massive risks, whether it's CDOs or whether it's an oil spill in the Gulf. Got to make sure that I, CEO, make a lot of money and have a golden parachute. That's what happens in an inappropriately regulated free market state with nascent monopolies and companies that are too big to fail. Sure. And in a state capitalist system where you have, you know, sort of state enterprises and private national champions that effectively are operating, you know, sort of at the whim and support of the state, what you have is frequently not short-termism to maximize economic profit. You have long-termism to maximize political stability that often supports a very small number of elites that are part of these authoritarian states. And that creates very different sorts of problems, but ultimately subverts the public will as well.
Clyde, I've got a web comment here that may, your response may shed light on this. This is from T. Branstad on the web. It says, "It's funny that China is racing toward the free market," he writes, "while the U.S. and Europe are racing towards socialism. Europe has about a 30-year head start on the U.S., but is there really any question why China is improving?" And then all caps with exclamation mark, "Capitalism. Capitalism is why China's in the lead," he says. What do you say, Clyde?
I think that China is not racing toward American-style capitalism. A critical point here is that in the U.S. system, let's say the Anglo system, the Brits are similar, we worship the market. So any what we think of as a market outcome is justified and we're satisfied with it. In the Chinese kind of system, or the Japanese, or the Singaporean, or even the German, the market's a tool. The objective, take the airplane, for example. The Chinese have a clear objective. They want to build jetliners. Obama didn't have the same objective in that comment that he made to Hu Jintao.
Boeing's one of our biggest exporters, one of our last big exporters.
Right, exactly. And so the point is that they will use the market if it serves their purposes. But if the market is not getting them where they want to get, they have no hesitation to tweak the market. And I think, you know, we fool ourselves in the U.S. I agree with the previous caller that the major big corporations, GM, AIG, Bank of America, guys like that, they are to some extent public corporations. But we in the U.S. have a mythology. We have this mythology that you know, we're free market capitalists and corporations are just doing their thing. So when they get in trouble, okay, we bail them out, but we don't have any strategy for them. We bail them out,
mm-hmm.
but we
go.
Say, well, we don't, you know, we don't want the government in there directing what they do. Now, the interesting thing is,
but
that
we've always
China,
thought that's the best way, Clyde. That in that free market, the best ideas, the best innovation, will triumph and succeed.
Well, we have, but I mean, let's take GM for example. GM would never have in China. GM would never have been allowed to get into the mess it was in. Because the Chinese would have, you know, they would have clearly identified it as a strategic industry, a strategic corporation that needs to be competitive. So they would never have allowed the kind of labor deals and the kind of management silliness that went on at GM
that hurt its competitiveness.
That, you know, eventually forced us to, in any case, get into GM as well.
But we've got, I mean, Ian, we've been told forever that you may like to control that, but there's no way that a bunch of bureaucrats are going to figure out how to make anybody competitive. On the contrary, I've got a question here from Facebook from Adipa. She says, China is clearly making some savvy moves in managing its economy. You described some of it in regards to labor at the outset of the show. Her question, she says, is, what is the economic brain trust in Beijing? Who are the managers of this thing?
Well, I think one of the things that's very impressive about the Chinese system is the fact that they are able to really put together strong consensus. When I talked about the three major strategies that Beijing is engaging in right now, I'm talking about really a swath across the top of the Communist Party leadership that is committed to diversifying exports, committed to building indigenous innovation, committed to building out Chinese domestic consumption. You don't have that level of consensus in the U.S. I mean, Congress is, you know, sort of a sum of very disparate parts, and they come from different constituencies with very different strong and embedded interests, different corporations, different labor movements.
But
and,
they should
and
have
the
same
rest.
Baseline goals, a more prosperous country, a more prosperous populace. I mean, that's right?
Well, I mean, if you have a baseline goal of a more prosperous West Virginia as opposed to a more prosperous California, as opposed to a more prosperous Iowa, you're going to get very different kinds of energy policy, agriculture policy, environmental policy. And I think that is one of the disadvantages in a crisis, especially when you're not growing, of a more decentralized representative democracy in the United States. China has very different problems. And I think you need to recognize mm-hmm. that when they start moving away from manufacturing towards more advanced economic growth, the lack of competence and the lack of compensation among mid and senior level bureaucrats in China is going to get them in the same sort of trouble that gives you reasons why you wouldn't want, you might want the American government to properly regulate mm-hmm. the financial industry and the oil industry and the automotive industry. But Lord knows you don't want them running those companies because they're just not capable of doing
that. And you don't think the Chinese government or Communist Party will be capable either?
Absolutely not. Not when we when you start talking about creating a real advanced economy with lots and lots of moving parts, there's a reason why they were starting to
right.
move more towards capitalism in the first place.
Well,
but they have moved back in the last 2 years, and that retrenchment is going to hurt them long term.
Toward more control. But Clyde, that seems, I think a lot of Americans will hear that again and think, look, if we sit tight, we'll be fine. Here's a web comment from a web. It says, as soon as wages throughout the world reach parity, true free market capitalism will be the best alternative, period. Clyde?
Well, we have a very long wait until wages around the world meet parity. But look, I think there's a myth that somehow we're going to move to higher ground, that our system will enable us to do the high-tech, the R&D, the sophisticated design. In fact, we used to say the sophisticated investment banking. We don't say that so much anymore because it turns out that our capitalist system wasn't too good in banking. But look, we have a big trade deficit in advanced technology. I remember back in the early 90s, we had a big trade deficit, but had a surplus in advanced technology. And so to make things look better, the Commerce Department created a new category in the reporting called advanced technology products. And they proudly showed we had a surplus in that. Well, now it's a $150 billion deficit. Now Applied Materials is moving its best technology to and its R&D to China in solar panels. We don't make fast trains. In fact, we don't have the technology to even think about making fast trains. So there's the truth is that the Chinese bureaucrats are not running these companies. They are guiding them. They're creating the incentives and the regulatory environment that strategically allows them to maximize their capability. And they're very conscious of the need to develop better skills, higher technology to move. They are very conscious of the need to move to higher ground, whereas we're not, actually. In the U.S., we're subsidizing agriculture, and we're continuing to pursue trade policies that that allow the dollar to be 40% overvalued. Obama says he wants to double exports. Well, how do you double exports when you allow the dollar to be 40% overvalued? Or why do you want to double exports? I mean, if you double exports and triple imports, you're behind. We don't have a strategy. The strategy would be to have the trade deficit. But nobody's talking about that in the U.S. In China, they do talk about that kind of thing.
A lot, I guess. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Ian, here's a Twitter question from Alan. He says, where does creativity and originality come from if countries like China are in charge?
Well, this is, I think, a place where Clyde and I probably seem to disagree the most, which is he keeps talking about Western firms that are plowing all of this technology into China, and they have been doing that. But I have to tell you, from going and talking to CEOs in the United States in the past 6 months, from being with Secretary Locke 2 days ago, Secretary of Commerce here, talking to the manufacturers union in Washington and the rest, there is a sea change in the way that American executives are thinking about bringing technology to China. And it's not just because the state is using the markets. It's because there is an absence of rule of law in China.
You mean the U.S. doesn't want to take it there anymore? They're afraid to take it there.
They're increasingly afraid, and a lot of them don't want to say it publicly because they still have – they've been going to China for so many decades. It takes corporations a while to learn lessons, you know. I mean, we see that over and over again.
Maybe China will build its own. It pushes innovation.
There's no question. It's possible that China will do some development. The U.S., of course, still spends vastly more money on R&D overall, as the Chinese does. The American economy is larger. Their educational institutions are vastly better than they are in China. There are big entrenched advantages, but you know, Chinese educational system is much more focused on rote and on memorization. The Chinese institutions, when you start talking to mid-level bureaucrats, there's much less entrepreneurship and individual autonomy in the way that they're structured. That's the problem of moving from a state planned economy to a state capitalist society to a free market one. It doesn't come costlessly.
But we thought that's why the U.S. would win in the end. Many still do or would like to. Mike in Waltham, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, my name is Mike. Long-time listener. I like your show a lot. Thanks for having me
Thank
on
you.
Today. You know, I agree with you know, what you're just talking about. I think in the end, the free markets and capitalism are going to prevail. You know, I'm a capitalist, I guess I would say. I work for a major corporation. I'm also a real estate agent. And from my perspective here, I think there's a lot of social unrest, a lot of problems going on kind of behind the scenes in China that we as Americans and you know, the Western world needs to kind of take into consideration when we're going to be investing there or corporations are going to be, you know, going over to China to do business. There's a book that I read a couple years ago. It's called The Nine Commentaries on the Chinese Communist Party. Mm-hmm. And it talks about a lot of the problems that have come about because of communism. And I think that's an important piece of literature that we should consider as people in the free market world.
Mike, let us pick it up right there. Clyde, we've only got a couple of minutes. Take us to your solution. Mike says, you know, free markets will win. There's plenty of turmoil under the covers in China. Again, we'll be fine, but you say no.
Well, I think we can win, but I think that we need to have a different approach to that. We need to recognize that China, and not only China, but much of Asia and even, as I said, countries like Germany have a strategy. We're kind of playing baseball. They're playing football. We can play football, but we keep insisting that the game is baseball, and so we're not responding.
But we've never had state-led strategy. That's just not the American way. We're the free market.
Oh, we have had state. Oh, absolutely. I mean, we gained dominance in the global economy through state-led strategies. The aircraft, the whole
U.S. scale of China
industry,
and Germany?
Very much so, yeah. The whole U.S. aircraft industry was a state-led strategy. People think of Eli Whitney as an entrepreneur, and he was, but he developed the cotton gin on the government contract. The telegraph was developed on a government contract. RCA Corporation was founded by the U.S. Navy. Became the world's leading consumer electronics company in the 20th century, founded by the U.S. Navy, 50% shareholder by the U.S. Navy for a number of years.
Ian, we've just got half a minute. Is that the solution? Do it their way and we'll be back in the game? Is that really the winning path?
Absolutely not. I mean, Germany may have strategy, but they're part of Europe. And as we've seen in the past several months, that strategy by themselves isn't getting them very far. I think we need to recognize the United States long term is going to grow on the basis of entrepreneurship. It's going to grow on the basis of technology and education and rule of law. We need to stick to our knitting and go back to the principles that made the country great.
Well, that would be anything but a consensus, I guess, but we've really had our eyes opened again here, and I'm grateful to both of you. Ian Bremmer's new book is The End of the Free Market. Ian, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Clyde Prestowitz is out with The Betrayal of American Prosperity, Free Market Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. Clyde, it's good to talk with you again. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. So good to see you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.